MacGyver in sepia. You are on deck in lead boots. Head breaking through a rubber suit. Necklace of bronze bolts and wing nuts. Helmet tucked under arm. Your mate, Pat, has winched you up from a greener world. Kept your hose supplied while you redressed barnacled rivets that weren't bucked enough when they first glowed red. Now you're adjusting to not breathing through a tube, bewildered by the light and weight of standing still in solid air. Or maybe this old print shows the start of your working day. Reluctant to be lowered, you try to make peace with Pat after winning his wages at cards last night, and whose wife gives you the nod when you're on separate shifts. You blather on about the davit, looking like the neighbour's stick, clattering your small fingers that day you both got caught nicking strawberries. Pat unwinds the hose, ties an unfamiliar knot in the rope around your waist.
Thank you. Great.
Mary O'Connor.
Thanks, Steve. This actually happened, and I tried to give as faithful an account of it as I could. It's kind of new agey and strange, but anyway, here it goes. Called Time Travellers. At daybreak, as our group stepped onto Tara's ancient site, our feet picked up unspoken grief that seemed to block the light. We pressed our backs against the oaks to feel their singing place, then moved along the windswept grass where boulders left their trace. Within our hollowed circle, pain pushed out from the stones. It made a woman gasp for breath when entering her bones. The tug of racial memory pulled back her startled gaze and fixed it on another time when blood bonds were betrayed. The ley lines seemed to buckle, heavy with history's weight. Assembled in the morning light, we sought a hidden gate, each holding with the inner eye the moment of release, as wise ones wrestled with the dead who had not found their peace. Their tribal ways were banned by those who spoke a foreign tongue. The sensitives among us opened to what would come. One quivered like a hazel switch that flags a hidden spring. His tears bore witness to a wrong that held a lasting sting. The wisest one among us, a shaman from the West, gathered our collective power and uttered a request. She asked for healing, peace, and light to seep into the earth, to free it from the druid's curse and wipe out High King's hurt. Linking with every element within the medicine wheel, her feather drew all harm away and made a solemn seal. There was a settling in the ground as we moved off the hill, aware that we'd been given a mission to fulfill. Thank you.
Emily Davis Fletcher.
Okay, this poem is in the voice of a mother pig, actually. So. It's called Sow Calling. I broke 3 records, and each time he brought me chocolate. So when I bore him another record litter, I didn't expect her. Up to her neck in silk, she wore the colors of earth in her eyes and hair, and held her breath like she'd never seen a sow so close before, or smelled one with so much city up her nose. She asked my name, and we both rolled our eyes. Big Mama, he teased. But I knew I was his best gal, because that's what he called when he threw chocolate my way. I always came whether he called or not, but I couldn't come now, even if I wanted to. I was pinned on my side and under the weight of 15 sucklings, relieved to finally see up close why he forgot supper some nights. Even from a distance, her delicacy stood out silly and strange. She brought 2 runts of her own who followed her like bleached shadows, walking on their toes, trying to pull away from so much dirt, stuck in their hair and eyes like their mamas. I thought for sure she'd want the house painted fresh, the windows barred with fragrant herbs and flowers. A green room made of what I could see when the screen door was held back by a bucket. He called this the mud room, and her girls followed suit, tiptoed around his battered boots and all sorts of chemicals to grow, kill, and clean. I loved watching flypaper twist from the ceiling like polka dot ribbons that pulled them girls' brown hair, their screams building higher and higher, scraping sky for their runt mama, sending her black and blue dog on duty, who only fit in at night when he slept, spread out and shiny, like oil spilled under a bare bowl in the mudroom. I watched for signs supper would come regular again. Weekly, her silk was roughed up on a line of kicking down. More often, her voice was thrown out of the house, carried by wind, wrapped around trees, bouncing off bales to stick in the mud, drowning out horse flies and rain, clogging my ears so I was down a sense, and straining my eyes beyond the fence to see her at the window, talking with her hands like pale stalks of grass rustled by wind, talking over TV, talking high and fast and unheard by everyone but me. Because I had no choice. Her hair whispered the earth. Her voice was mud. Crazy the way she'd let them girls escape with just a smack from the screen door for back talk. Content to let that black and blue dog watch them while she stayed in silk, a wall between her and ticks, clay pits, and copperheads. Sometimes them girls wouldn't run far, just creep along his bedroom window to peek at what kept their runt mama so quiet, till one sharp yell would send them shrieking downhill. Her black and blue dog cutting through October's hay, tearing the field in 2 to overtake them. I rested my eyes then, let myself sink into my own, with their mama hushed first foul, her black and blue dog playing nurse. Sure supper would come on time, but as much as I watched, I never saw it coming, the squeal that peeled my skin. I knew better than to follow his flash lamp or come when he brought supper late. He called, and I dug more in the muck, feeling nothing sucking or biting. Bats and birds clocked my eyes. He pushed his hands through the slates and tossed chocolate by my eyes. I let them return to mud. I was close to returning myself, and still her voice filled into my head, emptying the growl of his truck down gravel roads. High and fast, she called out strange and silly names for runts like herself that lifted me from my chosen skin to find my true calling. Not his best gal, but breaking glass.
Joel Sweeney's up next. Oh.
Now I hope this will be awesome. Entertaining and instructive. This is how to make an apple tart. It's entitled Apple Tart Recipe for Men. Ingredients: apple and tart. First step, get the apples. These can be bought readily enough, but if you live near someone with apple trees, it would be silly to waste money buying them. It will, however, require advanced planning. You must procure the apples the night before, as you're likely to be spotted in the daytime. Tools you will need. Tool 1, a knife. this should be blunt. Never use a sharp knife in a kitchen. They're far too dangerous. Sharp knives can save time, but you're better off saving lives. The flavour of a tart is totally spoiled if intrusive ingredients like chopped fingernail or blood are unwittingly included. So do use a blunt knife. It will take a little longer, but it's better than having your fingers a little shorter. With the blunt knife, cut the apples in half and lay them down flat on the board. It is now time to turn to your second tool. Tool two. A heavy mallet. Now your TV cook will be all into peeling and goring, slicing and dicing, but you needn't get fussed about any of that fancy stuff. It's not necessary. No need to even peel the apples. Leaving the skin on gives the whole affair a touch of colour, green or red, depending on the apples used. And don't worry about the pips, or the stem, or the spiky bits. These all can be left in. They're excellent sources of dietary fibre, and add interest and general excitement. Tool three, a wooden roller. This is an essential item. It helps you get the upper hand on the mixture. It helps to expose and even crush any alien objects that might have inadvertently slipped into the mix, like eggshells. It forces the mixture, which you laughingly call pastry, to lie flat and bow to your will. It is not unlike a steamroller flattening newly laid tar. It works on exactly the same principle, muscle over matter. And quite often I have achieved results which, though I don't like to boast, are as flat and hard as any roller. Now the procedure. Take the mallet. To be honest, a shovel or a wrench is just as good. And deliver a crushing blow to the halved apples. And go on beating them until there is no further resistance. Next, shovel 3/4 of a pound of flour into a bowl. Now if you're not good with weighing things, don't worry. 4 big handfuls is fine. If you feel this doesn't look right, throw in 2 or 3 more. But do not fill the bowl completely with flour. Leave room for the other ingredients. Now for liquid, you can use milk or water or beer even. I used beer once, but it didn't work well. The flour began to bubble up in an alarming and altogether disgusting way, so I wouldn't recommend it. Now another important thing to remember in connection with the liquid is not to put too much of it into the mixture, as you need to end up with something that you can roll out as pastry. If the mixture becomes too wet, it can sort of flow away from you when you turn it out onto a board. It can take on a life of its own, believe me, I know, and you can end up chasing it all over the kitchen, brandishing the roller. This is not satisfactory. Now, oh, by the way, did I mention the butter? Butter is an essential ingredient too, and can be squeezed from the wrapping foil quite easily direct into the flour. Squeeze until you feel enough is squirted out into the flour. It can help if you imagine you're wringing your boss's neck or the neck of your mother-in-law. I also use this motivational trick when I'm squashing and generally bashing the dough about. It makes it enjoyable too, and you're more likely to do the job thoroughly. Now, the general approach. When you've overcome the dough and it's not fighting back anymore, divide it in half. Now take the apples you've crushed with the mallet in your hands and pop them onto one half of the pastry. Then simply plunk the other half of the pastry on top and box your uncle or whatever. Now, sometimes the pastry can break up at the time like this, but you don't worry. A few final thumps with your fist and a few delicate finger movements can usually sort the pastry out. Now, one final warning. Try to keep the final mould moving all the time, as I found that it can sometimes tend to set before it gets anywhere near the oven. A rolling stone gathers no moss. Not, of course, that you want it to gather moss, though sometimes if you leave it hanging around too long, it can gather mould. I found this in the past, but if you stick it in the oven at high temperature, all moss or mould will be killed off quickly. Now, just remember, give it plenty of air as you head for the oven. Sweep around as much as possible. Many famous chefs, particularly French and Spanish, do this, creating a sense of panache and giving them an air of importance. Now place the mixture quickly in the oven at 200 degrees Celsius or whatever. Just don't turn it up to full, as there's no point in being burnt alive or choked by fumes as well as going hungry. All you have to do now is wait. It is, I think, safer not to wait in the kitchen. There's no need to lock the door or anything like that, but do close it firmly. If you feel that things might not work out too well and are uneasy about remaining in the house, I would advise dropping in on a neighbour with a six-pack and watching the match. You can always ring the fire brigade from his house.
That's Joseph. And Carl Holland.
So I'm trying to make a new material, so I'm going to give it a blast at fighting the man.
Right.
Once I remember it. All my life I've wanted to fight the man. The trouble was, I could never find him. I asked my friends and family, neighbours and strangers, but all I got was laughter, abuse, and occasional pulses. I changed my tactics. I made a sandwich board that said, "Have you seen the man?" Stood on prominent street corners in the central business district of major cities. All I found were people who seemed to know where Jesus was. I didn't want to fight Jesus. I wanted to fight the man. I sent letters in the post, 12 noon by the old clock tower, no shooters, and the postman didn't know who the man was either. I wrote letters to celebrities, presidents, prime ministers, and the ambassadors of 72 countries. "Dear sir or madam, have you seen the man?" All I got was a personalised response from famous hip-hop artist Secretary that said, "You the man." I didn't like that one for a little while. I didn't realise that I didn't want to fight myself. I wanted to fight the man. I stooped as low as manfinder.com. I went on the radio. I asked the country. All I got was a 20-minute segment on national television called "Looking for the Man." A journalist showed up on my doorstep. I started receiving fan mail. "Good luck finding the man," and "Give him one for me." People started putting up posters. I found air travel tickets in my letterbox. I went on tour to the Isle of Man, Salt Maid of Oman, and Suriname, which was in there backwards. I made inspirational speeches. I talked to audiences of thousands, an open rock concert from a little number called "Looking for the Man." I went on Oprah. I talked to Dr. Phil. I autographed knuckle dusters, breasts, and small animals. I was beginning to enjoy myself. I bought a small island in the Bahamas with the proceeds of my autobiography, Manhunter. I married a local girl, had two more on the side, and bought a yacht when the book became a movie. I invested wisely. I fired my crooked accountant the week before his arrest and founded a small private bank. I dealt exclusively with deposits of presidents, prime ministers, celebrities, and ambassadors of six countries with a solid financial system. I bought a bigger yacht, an airline, and an oil field. I had my face on billboards from Manhattan to Mandalay. I was Time Magazine's Man of the Year. I was Forbes Magazine's Man of the Year. Was National Geographic's Man of the Century. I was the fucking man.
Wednesday at 9 o'clock in the Cult Cafe. Lucy Pascal, if I'm pronouncing that right. No, I'm not pronouncing that right, but you know who you are. Would you pronounce it correctly?
Pasquale. This is called Wildfire. I know I stare with quiet eyes, but it is only because my mind is so loud. You think I am idle, but I am just working out in my head the best possible way to put my hands to use. You think I am too cautious, but danger zones make my heart go wild. I am just doing my best to appear sane. You see sunflowers on my lips and taste honeysuckle on my breath, but your ears ignore the tremors in my voice. You say my skin's surface lays smooth like marble, but that is only because my body is a mausoleum. And my scars are in places you're not allowed to see. You run your fingers through my hair and press your palms to my cheeks and then try to tell me you cannot feel the flames that run beneath the surface of my skin. I told you I am a wildfire in the middle of a Santa Ana wind, but you insisted on feeling the burn.
Last call. And Adam Waite. Adam Waite is next.
I've got the one from my book here, which was launched about a week ago in Galway, but I'm going to try and do it just like the man. I'll try and without it, and then I'll just leave it here for just in case. This is a poem called English for the Workplace. I teach English, but English for the workplace, 2 nights a week. Conversation skills that can't be killed due to such sheer disregard on the back line. Nouns with dry mouths found in the trenches, biting their fists. Vocabulary lists for the desperate. On Tuesday evenings, I school them in asking politely for customers to serve, shoplifters to observe, for beds to make, someone else's children to feed, change, cradle, and wake, even to earn a living from someone lording it in the castle of Gort, who wants you to walk his mutt, keep a sharp eye out for fear his pedigree shit might sit in the wrong place. And for tables to wait on. He who's used to snipping pieces of furniture out of lengths of wood he's had reduced to the right size. Who once hewed a roof out of a tree his father felled. My father carpenter also. He built a lovely house in Krakow. He's very big. Wednesday is a workshop for words you need in greeting, dealing in urbanities. Adjectives that brand the self. For this, we pass around the medicine ball of intonation. It's a sweaty gym of vowels and consonants where pupils, like pugilists, come to build up tongue muscle, await the weigh-in for the first round of formal introductions, unforeseen meetings, even GP consultations. It's a right, left, punching the S left unexpressed, and no one here is allowed to throw in a damp towel of inarticulation. I pair them off to pretend across tables that they've never met, to extract rudimentary information. The classroom becomes a drop-in centre for recovering mutes. She who composed a thesis on folk music in Kundera, who translated the meaning of her childhood into free verse, the carpenter and the scholar, the poet trying to get a stiff word in edgeways. My mother poet also, she published in Czech. It was very, very difficult. Everyone say hello.
And the last one on the list is Kieran McGarren. Kieran.
The playground. You can see the world as a playground and climb the monkey bars and produce nothing but omissions from fast and shining cars as you drive from pleasure to pleasure, desire to desire, and build little sandcastles and then build them up higher and sell them to your neighbor trying to make it on their own, who had just what you had, except said, no, I do not own. These shells that I've collected looked prettier in the sand than I could ever make them shine as I hold them in my hand.
Thank you.